Well, good evening and welcome to the members' room. I'm Mark Bartlett. Can you all hear me? Yes. Welcome to a very special evening, and I first of all have to thank you all and clap to thank you for coming out on a very blustery and wet evening. When I got up this morning and I saw the rain, my heart kind of sank, and I thought, it's going to stop. It's going to get sunny. Right. It's a real pleasure to have so many people here tonight for what I think the library will always be proud of, a very important project, the celebration and launch of the first charging ledger. Tonight, I'm joined by the staff members who worked so hard on the first charging ledger project. To set up this evening, let me explain that our program will run about 30 minutes of formal remarks by Tom Fleming and Ingrid Richter, and then we invite you to visit the display of rare books out in the Peluso Exhibition Gallery, and also downstairs in the reference room. We have one of the two volumes of the ledger displayed, and George Munoz, our conservator, has a very nice presentation down there on the conservation of the first ledger. The program that you have in your hands is a companion to this evening's festivities. We wanted to give you some of the information that you're going to hear about, and we also wanted to give you a few other things. We also have soft drinks, wine, refreshments here in the members' room, and I'm proud to let you know, for those of you who enjoy beer, we also have a sampling of microbrewed beer in honor of this generation of New Yorkers who did like to imbibe beer. So we have some microbrewed beer from various parts of the world, including Belgium, Quebec in Canada, and here in New York City as well. It's partly in honor of one of the books in our first ledger, which is Combrune on Brewing, a book that was circulated numerous times to only one member. I'm not sure what the story was, but Alexander Robertson borrowed Combrune on Brewing, which has come down in history as a very important book on the topic. Alas, we no longer own Combrune on Brewing, but I have seen auction prices for it on the internet for rather steep amounts. As many of you know, the Society Library is a place that likes to celebrate its past. The great collection, the everyday achievements, the many New Yorkers who have passed through our stacks, and the occasional, let's call them what they are, the occasional mishaps that have happened since we started with a collection of books back in 1754. We are now in our fifth home here at 79th Street, but it was in our last home at 109 University Place that the early charging ledger of 1789 to 1792 was found again. At some point in the 18th century or the 19th century, we're not quite sure, the first ledger had been misplaced, but in 1934, it was reportedly found in a pile in the basement of our former building. This I would categorize as one of the library's great mishaps. Well, here we are tonight, breathing some new life into our first ledger and its contents. It's a real achievement that we're able to marry the great library science traditions of preservation, access, and cataloging with, let me call them, the wonders of technology to make the ledger available to the world. We hope that our efforts on this project will facilitate more scholarship and be a very good aid to historians, educators, and all interested parties throughout the world. It's my role, of course, to thank the many people who have been involved with this project, so let me try to do that fairly quickly. First of all, many thanks to one of our very loyal library members, our archivist, Edmay Wright, who is our archivist and guardian of the archives and ledgers of the library. I would like to acknowledge the Board of Trustees of the library for providing financial support for conserving and digitizing the charging ledgers back in 2007. Many of the trustees were very positive about the ledger project, but I would certainly like to thank our past chairman, William Dean, and our current chairman, Charles Berry, for being very strong advocates when this all began. The first ledger was conserved in 2007 by a company called the Northeast Document Conservation Center in Massachusetts, And I do want to publicly recognize the NEDCC and to mention the name of Deborah Wender, who has been very helpful through this whole project and will certainly be helpful in ongoing projects here at the Society Library. The Gladys Kriebel Delmas Foundation provided very generous support to the library's archives and charging ledgers in 2008. It was the Delmas grant that helped us burn the midnight oil in the last year and reach our goal, launching the website on November 1st. I also thank a number of library members who supported the archives in the last few years, including those who earmarked their spring appeal contribution for archives work. Let me also thank Nina Root, who is here with us tonight in the back row. Nina, a NISL member since 2001. She's a writer and the Director Emeriti of the American Museum of Natural History Research Library. As you will read in your program, Nina has authored really just a sparkling and interesting article on the first ledger, and I applaud her for this. We will add Nina's article to our website. Our first charging ledger project reflects the work of a number of library staff, from the Conservation Department, George Munoz, from cataloging, Aravik Kaprilian, Laura O'Keefe, Matthew Haugen, Perry Pignetti, and Tim Conley, and from the systems team, Derek Stadler, Alan Baylor, and the fearless and hardworking project coordinator, Ingrid Richter. I want to thank them all. I do want to give special thanks to Ingrid for her very keen approach, patience, and her general sense of good humor for the last few years. I also applaud the library's rare book librarian, Aravik Kaprilian, who has been the principal cataloger and the Sherlock Holmes on these early library holdings. She tackled the ledger holdings analysis with a real renewed enthusiasm. Thank you, Ingrid, and thank you, Aravik. Before Ingrid demonstrates the first ledger, let me close with some very good news that we did want to share with you, and this news just came in at the end of last week. The Delmas Foundation has just awarded us a second grant. It's towards a new project, which is the transcription, analysis, and cataloging of the second ledger. Now, you're here to hear about the first ledger, but let me finish by telling you that the second ledger has 600 pages in it. It covers the period 1799 to 1805, and many members who we've been studying the last 2 years and are represented in the first ledger continue into the second ledger. Also in the second ledger are many very important names from New York history: John Jacob Astor, John Jay, Frederick DePeyster, the chairman of both our library and the president of the Historical Society, Peter Augustus Jay, the eldest son of John Jay, and Peter R. Maverick, who engraved the second bookplate of the library. The working list of names in the second ledger, I swore to my staff that I wouldn't show this to people, but it's a huge document of about 8 pages, which we've not filtered down and corrected, but it's fairly impressive, the list of members in the second ledger. We must continue to raise funds to support the conservation and digitization and all the work to do with the second ledger and the other holdings in our very rich archives. And for those of you who are library members, please do let us know if you're interested in supporting the next project. And now I will sit down and perhaps have a glass of water or a drink of beer and turn the podium over to Ingrid Richter, the head of systems of our library. And in all her spare time, she's the project coordinator of the Ledger project. And she will now demonstrate for us the First Ledger website.
My goodness, I've never had such an introduction before. This is fantastic. For those of you who might know me, I've taught a bunch of technology workshops here, but I'm also the person who is in charge of all things digital in the library and computers and systems and everything else. So what happened after we got this digitization, the ledger digitized, we had a whole bunch of images, and Mark handed them off to me and said, go ahead and do something with them. Make a website. Do something interesting. Make this available for people to visit. So I took the images, and with the help of a ton of people, which Mark all had already gone through, we actually created a website. We have about 2,000 pages right now that are related to this Ledger website, so it's going to be here. I'm going to be here for a while, guys. So I'm going to go through every single one of them. Actually, no. Mark gave me a five-minute time limit, so I promise this will be quick and painless. I'll also be available afterwards for any questions. If anyone has anything, I'll be downstairs with the terminals. The first thing I think people would want to know is, how do you actually find the ledger? You can go into Google and search for the first charging ledger, but on our webpage, on the main page, which hopefully looks familiar to a lot of you, it's under projects right now. It's the first charging ledger link. That will bring you to this page, which has a little bit brief description. I'm going to just jump right in and actually go down one more. We have the list of our names. Off to the side, we have the cover, and we have some of our list of members. We also have a chronological breakdown of the page. This should look exactly the same at your home as it does right here. If it doesn't, let me know, and I'll try to fix it as soon as possible. The first person I decided to pick, actually, and the only person, because we have about 500 people listed here, is John Jay. I didn't want to go with the obvious choice of George Washington, since I'm sure all of you will be checking out his page. Alexander Hamilton's great, but he sent in his representative and only checked out two books. John Jay actually read quite a few more books. So if you click on the John Jay link, you'll bring up two images and a biography. And if you, if you check right here, you'll notice that this is actually the ledger page. If you click on it, it will bring up John Jay's section of ledger. This looks very strange, and I outlined it in red, just because when they first started out, they were doing one page per person. John Jay was this entire page. Later on, they were adding more and more people. They actually added Samuel Jones Jr. He's off to the right of this page. So John Jay stretched out for about 10 entries, and then another person started. His run is this full ledger page. And again, this will be full on your computer screen. You should be able to read all of the names and dates on here. That said, we thought you might actually not want to read all of those names, or the handwriting might be a little bit complicated, so we transcribed them for you. We're still in the midst of working out some of the kinks, so if you notice any errors, please let us know, and we'll fix them as soon as possible. But this first column here, you see, is the date that was checked out. The second column is the title of the book. The third column is the volume. The fourth column is the size. The fifth column is when the book was returned. Then we have a couple of random columns for fines and for other people who brought them in. And the final column here is the actual page of the ledger that this appeared on. You'll notice we actually have some earlier pages here. These are, were when the ledger was being done chronologically. So for the first 35 pages, everything was chronological. After that, they broke them down into individual readers. We've intermingled them all together on the page. This is the breakdown of the dates and the chronological pages. Then we'll start getting into members later on. Now, some interesting facts here, breaking down from the back. Rep is the representative or the person who came in. For John Jay, his son came in to check out Baron de Tott. Actually, his son came in a lot in the early days. So I did a little bit of research, not very hard. I just checked on Wikipedia. John Jay's oldest son was Peter Augustus Jay. He was born in 1776. John Jay only had two sons. His second son was born in 1789, so probably wasn't him. So we were pretty sure that Peter Augustus Jay is also in the ledger. He's not mentioned by name, however. He was coming in and picking up books. Kind of a fun little fact. The second thing you'll notice here, I have this pointed 12MO. This is actually shorthand notation for the size of the book that was checked out. And if you click on the link, it will bring you to duodecimo, which is 12 leaves and everything. For any time you see any size or anything underlined in blue, you'll be able to get more information about what this item was. The last part, which is the interesting part, is the book, of course. And if you click on any of the books that are underlined in blue, and any of the books that have been bold are even more special, you'll come to a full list of the book and everyone who checked this book out when we were doing this. This is where our website just grew exponentially. We have 1,200 books that were used and circulated here. But this is also where it becomes really fun, because you can see who's checking out volumes and who's coming next in the list and that sort of information. You'll notice we have mentioned in 1789 catalog. This is how we identified most of the titles. We actually have our early ledgers or books that we owned at the time. If you click on the 1789 catalog, it will bring you to a PDF version of a scanned copy of this catalog, and we'll also show you where we found this book in the catalog. If the local note says in library, and I'm pleased to announce that quite a few of our books do, you can click on the link and it will take you to our beautiful cataloging record with full information on here. If you click down, you'll see even more information about the ledger itself. This is for all the books that were in the first charging ledger that we still have in our collection to this day, which is amazing, and we have several of them outside. Erevig would love to demonstrate these books, show some of these books. So if you ever wanted to return back to the first ledger, or if you were browsing through our catalog and you stumbled across this page, you would just click back on the first ledger circulation history page. And at any of the pages at the bottom, if you see the word ledger, just click on that. It will bring you back to the main site. Now, I realize with 2,000 pages, you probably don't want to go alphabetically through every single one of them. So if you're interested in some topic, some book, or some subject, I included a search engine on here. This will limit it down just to the 2,000 pages that we have. I used the example Egypt. I was just trying to find some interesting search to do. You'll notice this looks a lot like Google. It actually is a Google search page, but it's only showing library results. And it will mingle everything together. We have a book result on the first page, we have a page result on the second page, and we have a person, or a second result, and we have a person on the third page, third result. And if you're interested in a little bit more and discovering more about this ledger project, we have quite a few other links here. We have the green index pages, which are our major indexes. We have all of our books that were listed, all of the pages of the ledger, including what was on each page, and all of the people mentioned in the ledger, but we didn't mention sons or anything like that. For the information pages, we have about, conservation, citation, and credits. All of them are interesting. They contain more information about this project and some sort of places to go for further research. And that's it for my 5-minute presentation, but I will be around afterwards to answer questions. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to now introduce Thomas Fleming, who's a library member and an author of more than 40 books of fiction and nonfiction, most recently The Intimate Lives of the Founding Fathers, which we have up here displayed at the front of the room. He has been the president of the Society of American Historians and of the Pan American Center. He's a frequent guest on C-SPAN, PBS, A&E, and the History Channel. He's been a very good friend to the library and a very good friend to this project. Please welcome Tom Fleming.
Oh, thank you, Mark. It's what a pleasure it is to be able to talk about history with all these with all you people who care about history. That's what historians like to do. I think we could, obviously, why are we here, I guess you might say. This is a charging list. This is such a marvelous story. But it's those names, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, John Adams, and John Jay. They're the main reason why we have been attracted, I guess you'd say, to the ledger's rehabilitation as a historical document. And as you've heard from Mark, it had a perilous life there in the 19th century, coming within an inch of being thrown out with the trash. And instead, it traveled uptown to this much more spacious building and was preserved to give us a chance to do this wonderful job on it today. But before we get to the historic reading habits of these famous names, there's another story worth telling. From 1754, the date of our founding, the library had steadily accumulated members and books. By the time the American Revolution erupted in New York, it had almost 1,300 volumes, a formidable collection in those days when books were printed and stitched together by hand. Their home was an ample room in the old City Hall on Wall Street. In 1776, George Washington's Continental Army was driven from New York by the invading British. Congress had sternly forbidden him to do anything to harm the city. It had to be kept intact. That was his orders. But Washington was rapidly becoming a master of clandestine warfare. He looked the other way while teams of incendiaries set New York ablaze to deprive the British of winter quarters. Later, the general attributed the conflagration to divine providence or some honest fellow. You get the message, don't you? About 20% of New York's buildings, including Trinity Church, became charred ruins. And in the ensuing chaos, the Society and Library's collection was looted by infuriated British soldiers and sailors who sold the books at nearby grog shops for a few gulps of rum. The library more or less ceased to exist. In 1788, New York became the capital of an independent nation with a new constitution and a new government. A plaintive notice appeared in the newspapers asking, and I quote, "such persons who have in their possession any of the books belonging to the New York Society Library to please return them to any of several trustees." A surprising number of books surfaced. 600, no less, were discovered somewhere inside St. Paul's Chapel, apparently hidden there and forgotten for the previous decade. In 1789, the library reopened in the same building on Wall Street, now remodeled and christened Federal Hall. It housed not only the city government, but also the two branches of the new Congress and the offices of the president and vice president. Some people have argued that this cozy relationship with the federal government entitles us to claim we were the first Library of Congress. I think this is a bit of a stretch. If anyone deserves that unofficial title, it's the Library Company of Philadelphia, which opened its shelves to the 1774 Continental Congress and continued the policy until Congress retreated, I should say fled, really, to Princeton in 1783 to escape bayonet-wielding soldiers demanding back pay. Nevertheless, our historic flirtation with the new federal Congress may behoove us to ponder the way our predecessors managed to team up with the nation's political arm, giving the library a sort of semi-official status. Does this suggest that we ought to consider laying our contemporary hands on some federal stimulus money? We could argue it's one of our hallowed traditions. Let's leave that to the trustees and move on to the famous names that began appearing in the charging ledger in 1789. The first, of course, is President Washington. He took out one volume of a series devoted to the debates of the British Parliament, and a second book, The Law of Nations, by a Swiss historian named Emer de Vattel, or de Vattel, I suppose. My French is terrible. This book was one of the first attempts to create a workable set of international laws. The Vattel book has serious historical significance. I plan to discuss it in a book I'm writing about George Washington's presidency. One of his primary goals was to assert the authority of his new office in the field of foreign policy. The Vattel book dovetailed neatly with something else that Washington did in his first few weeks in office. He sent letters to the rulers of every country in Europe informing him that if they wished to conduct any business with the new United States, they should write to him, not Congress. Congress had demonstrated a notable ineptitude when it tried to conduct foreign policy affairs through various committees. In one of my recent books, I actually counted up the number of committees Congress had going by 1783. It came to something like 3,274. And they had to, even in the first year of 1775, they had to appoint a committee on committees to find out what the hell was going on. Washington knew all this, although Congress did have a president, he was a totally powerless figurehead. He couldn't even answer a letter. He had to give it to a committee. On to the next federal customer in our charging ledger. This was Vice President John Adams. He appeared personally in the library. Washington is just listed as president. He obviously sent an aide or somebody to take the book out. He appeared personally, Adams did, to take home volume one of Elements of Criticism by the noted Scottish writer Lord Henry Kames. If Honest John, as Adams called himself, had known this was one of Benjamin Franklin's favorite books, and Lord Kames had been one of Ben's most fervent admirers, I'm sure he never would have gone near the book. Adams and Franklin did not become friends during the several years they spent in Europe as fellow diplomats. Honest John wrote numerous scathing letters to Congress claiming that Franklin indulged in orgies with French women. I don't think that's true, incidentally. Ben informed Congress that Adams was, and I quote, always an honest man, often a wise man, but sometimes, and in some things, absolutely out of his senses. I love that one. Nobody could do it better than Ben. In these first days as vice president, I'm afraid to report that John Adams demonstrated this latter trait to a dismaying degree. He informed the U.S. Senate that he thought George Washington's title should be His Highness, the President of the United States. In letters and formal addresses, he recommended calling Washington His Majesty, and he thought the vice president deserved the same title. Fortunately for the stability of the republic, James Madison, the man who wrote most of the Constitution, was in Congress. Probably after consultation with Mr. Washington, with whom he was on intimate terms, Madison persuaded the House of Representatives to vote overwhelmingly to address the leader of the nation as Mr. President. The vice president, I regret to report, became the butt of jokes. A senator from South Carolina won the biggest laugh by suggesting Honest John should be called His Rotundity. Alexander Hamilton, newly appointed as Secretary of the Treasury, borrowed two novels, The Amours of Count Poliziana and Eleonora, and according to the ledger, a history of Edward Mortimer, which the librarian briskly noted was written by a lady. Both choices suggest two things. Mr. Hamilton was absolutely confident, and this was one of his great traits, that he needed no additional information on government finances. And he may have been having problems juggling his affection for his devoted, deeply religious wife, Elizabeth, and his passionate attraction to his shapely sister-in-law, Angelica Schuyler Church, a woman of fashion. Aaron Burr revealed the two sides of his complex nature in his book selections. His first choice in 1789 was Revolution in Geneva, devoted to the tumultuous history of that early venture into radical Protestant government. Next came a volume by Jonathan Swift, followed by The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon. In 1790, Burr became devoted to the famous French skeptic, Voltaire, devouring no less than 9 volumes of his anti-establishment essays and satires. Simultaneously, he was enjoying 2 novels, Mysterious Husband and False Friend, titles which can be used to further blacken Mr. Burr's reputation. I'm one of the few historians, however, who decline to dismiss Burr as a scoundrel. I see him as a victim of one of the most savage political massacres by slander of any American that any American politician has ever undergone. The man in charge of this little operation was the President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson. The chief scandalmongers were those 2 esteemed citizens of our city, DeWitt Clinton, mayor of New York, and his uncle George, the governor of our great state. Together, these gentlemen destroyed Burr when he dared to run for governor of New York on the Federalist, that was the opposition, ticket. I tell the nasty story in detail in my 1999 book, Duel, a Joint Biography of Burr and Hamilton. Back to our charging ledger. The last of the famous patrons, as we've already heard, is John Jay, one of the architects of the peace treaty with Britain that ended the American Revolution and the first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. If I listed all the books Jay took out, we'd be comatose before I got halfway through. They range from Don Quixote to Plutarch's Lives to Captain James Cook's report on his circumnavigation of the globe. And as you've also heard, Jay and his descendants remained active members and supporters of the library well into the 20th century. When it comes to historical excitement, however, we're only warming up. Hidden in the charging ledger's pages, is shocking information about the greatest of our early patrons, George Washington. It has to do with something we seldom associate with this great man, failure. In 1791, after little more than a year in New York, Congress succumbed to Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson's dislike of large cities and his even more intense dislike of a stock exchange. And they voted to move to Philadelphia for 10 years while a new federal city was built in a wilderness we now call Washington, D.C. It was the price Jefferson exacted for agreeing to Alexander Hamilton's brilliant plan to create a Bank of the United States and pay off the national debt by selling shares in it. I should emphasize that Jefferson by this time was leader of the opposition political party called Republicans, although most historians now call them Democratic Republicans. In the sound and fury surrounding this debate, President Washington departed for Philadelphia without returning Emma de Vattel's book on international law. No doubt the keepers of the library's charging ledger were well aware of our failure. But they hesitated to badger the President of the United States. Perhaps they convinced themselves that Washington continued to find the book useful. In 1792, the French Revolution exploded into an all-out war with Great Britain and several other European states. Washington decided the United States should remain neutral in this huge imbroglio. To further assert the power of the presidency, he waited until Congress had adjourned to issue his Declaration of Neutrality. Pro-French congressmen and others, notably Thomas Jefferson, were infuriated and made life very uncomfortable for the president for the next 4 years. Nothing was said or done on the library side of the story, and President Washington went home to Mount Vernon at the end of his second term with the Vattel book in his luggage. By this time, the great man was 65 years old and growing a little forgetful. He sold a handsome desk to the widow of the mayor of Philadelphia, and she found in one of its drawers a packet of his letters, which she breathlessly informed the ex-president were written to a lady. Only much later, in the teasing letter, did she reveal that the lady was Martha Washington. Washington liked to correspond with flirtatious women. He told this vamp, who incidentally was very pretty, that if a reader of the letters hoped to warm her or himself with the flame of a romance, he or she would be better advised to light a fire instead. But the letters were rich in something better than romance, friendship. It was one of his most touching tributes to his four decades of marriage with the former Martha Dandridge Custis. Fast forward to the 21st century. The charging letter is on its way to rehabilitation, and details of its contents are beginning to circulate. Little do we realize that the omnipresent media of our time might find it interesting, even titillating, to report that George Washington wasn't perfect after all. Suddenly there blossomed in various newspapers, such as the Christian Science Monitor, the Manchester England Guardian, and the New York Daily News, a report on the Vattel book with an estimate that Mount Vernon owed the Society Library at least $300,000. I regret to report that figure is much too low. If we start translating 1790 money into current dollar values, the price of the debt skyrockets by a multiple of at least 20. And if President Obama and his friends keep depreciating the dollar, the figure may soon be a multiple of 40. I estimate we're looking at a possible debt of $32 million. At this point, I have to wonder if fantastic visions dance through the heads of our leaders, Chairman of the Board Charles Berry and Library Director Mark Bartlett. Did they see themselves in a court of law, listening to a judge declare them, in the name of the Society Library, the principal stockholders in the corporation that now operates Mount Vernon? Did they imagine themselves on the veranda of the mansion, enjoying the superb views of the Potomac and summoning one of the members of the Mount Vernon Ladies Association to serve congratulatory mint juleps? Alas, this Berry Bartlett triumph wasn't to be. The man who runs things at Mount Vernon, Executive Director James Reese, decided it was time to take the initiative. Mr. Reese summoned Joan Stahl, his librarian, and said, "Find a copy of that Vattel book. Price is no object. I wouldn't be surprised if these New Yorkers see this as revenge for the way the general, some good honest fellow tried to burn down their city in 1776. Of course, I don't know whether Mr. Reese really said that, but it would be convincing dialogue in an historical novel, which I like to write. Miss Stahl went to work, and presto, for a mere $1,200, she found a copy of the missing book. Some media mavens, getting things wrong as they often do, said the price was $12,000, and that got on the papers. Soon there was a meeting here in the library. I was honored to be among the invited members. Mr. Reese and Miss Stahl handed over the missing volume to Chairman Charles Berry, who graciously announced that any and all overdue fines would be considered paid in full. There was grandiosity even. Mr. Reese paid us a compliment in return. He chose our members' room, this room, as the place to announce Mount Vernon's plans to build a $150 million library at Mount Vernon devoted to scholarship on Mr. Washington. Now, don't for a moment think the history that streamed through the Society Library's portals ends here. It continues for another 220 years. There's a wonderful memoir by Marion King, Books and People, that I urge everyone to read. Perhaps the library will consider republishing it to make it more widely available. Mrs. King came to work for the library in 1909 and stayed until 1954. Her account teems with vivid pen portraits of the library staff before and after these years. There's a wonderful glimpse of Helen Ruskell coming to work in July 1920 at the age of 18. She was still presiding at the front desk when I arrived in the 1960s. There are marvelous anecdotes, many from the old University Place headquarters. One day, a gentleman tottered in, obviously very drunk. He wobbled to the large pictures on the wall, bowed his head before each one, and muttered to himself. It dawned on Mrs. King that he thought he was in a chapel and he was saying the Stations of the Cross. After 15 minutes, he blessed himself and stumbled happily into the street. Even better is a gentleman who took advantage of the standing rule that we still have that the library is open to the public for research. He explained he was a genealogist and soon had a dozen or so books around him in the reading room. He liked the surroundings so much, he came back every day for the next 32 years. Best of all are Mrs. King's recollections of her friendship with Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt. Some of you may have seen the exhibit of their letters in the Peloso Gallery not long ago. In some ways, it's more interesting to read about these two remarkable women in the ongoing context of Mrs. King's relationship to the library. That way, it's a sort of bonus, while around them streams Mrs. King's priceless memories of fellow workers and patrons, such as the dignified lady who carefully pointed out all the immoral passages in every novel she took out. Even more memorable are recollections of the writers who skyrocketed onto the bestseller list, forcing the library to buy as many as 40 copies of their books. We don't do that anymore, I don't think, do we, Mark? In almost every case, both the writers and the books are totally forgotten today. It's sobering to see the rough game history plays with writers' reputations, but it also helps us understand the importance of this institution, where the forgotten books and writers live on, waiting to be rediscovered by the mysterious force that David Halberstam called the serendipity of the stacks. You just put your hand out, and there's a book. Mr. Halberstam's essay on the library is on our website and shouldn't be missed. He tells some very good stories, too. Perhaps his best describes how Truman Capote struck up a conversation with a dignified elderly woman in the members' room and invited her to join him for a cup of coffee. And when they got there, Capote remarked he just finished a wonderful book, My Antonia, and he urged her to read it. "Actually, I wrote it," the lady said.
And she introduced herself as Willa Cather. Is there an historical reason to be learned? Is there an historical lesson to be learned from this celebration of our charging ledger? As a serious historian, I gave this question hours of thought. I concluded George Washington's story should warn all of us to get our books back on time. You don't want the Society Library to suddenly foreclose on the nice vacation home your descendants of the 23rd century have just bought on Mars. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Fleming. That was tremendous. I just want to remind you that there's more to come. Don't go away. Don't touch that dial. we invite you now to enjoy wine, beer, sparkling water, various other potables over there. There are also some light refreshments around the room to take a look at the display of books mentioned at the First Charging Ledger, which is in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery directly outside this room. And also, if you haven't done so already, to head downstairs to the reference room on the first floor, where there's a really interesting display about the conservation process for the ledger and where Ingrid Richter, who presented here earlier on how to use the website, will do a little demonstration for you, hands-on. Question? As far as we know, and maybe you can contradict me on this, but exactly, women have been members since the very beginning of the library, as far as we know. And I might just say, unlike our sister institution, the Boston Athenaeum, who didn't let women be members from their inception, which is somewhat later than ours. So yay us, I say. And any of the staff members who are wearing name tags will be happy to answer any questions you have about the ledger or the library. Enjoy.